So we know that there was bipartisan support on the state budget, which again is a two-year budget, $51 billion, a little more than that. And we know that there was going to be an awful lot of money being dumped into state aid for local school districts. And how much would you say? According to the AP, an additional $329 million is going to be pushed into the education sector, is what I say. And I put that in air quotations because I have friends, I have family members who are teachers here in Connecticut, and they serve some of the hardest districts, including Bridgeport, Norwalk, and Stamford. And when I tell them, oh, we've got historic amounts of money going into education, they're like, yeah, what? And where exactly is it going? So I thought, you know what? I'm going to have the experts come on and give some perspective. Who better to talk to than Fran Rabinowitz back with us today? We've got Fran, who is the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. Fran, thank you so much for coming back on. And I can't wait to dive into this today. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. And thank you for having me.
So, of course, first of all, were you happy with the amount of money that's going into it? Do you understand where that money is really going? What was your reaction to the state budget?
Well, frankly, I was very pleased with the amount of time and energy that went into education on the part of the legislature this year and the ability to speak with education chairs and talk to them about what we thought they were putting forward. It wasn't the full amount that we asked for in House Bill 5003, but it was a very good start.
Okay, so what are some of the good things you feel is going to come out of this money that is being allotted to education?
So let me begin by saying that, you know, I can give you a rundown of all of the, you know, I can't tell you exactly what Bridgeport's going to get yet or Norwalk, but I can say that certainly there is $150 million more in the excess cost grant, which is excellent. They also held, and this was our particular piece from the superintendent's organization, they held all districts harmless. Some of the small districts, for instance, in Southwest Fairfield County Litchfield County were slated to lose money. And we did fight and say, no one should lose money. Let's just add dollars, and certainly to the most challenged districts. So that happened. There was an additional $25 million in excess costs for special education, which we also have been fighting for. And we're hoping, it depends upon the costs, but we're hoping that that will be full funding. And we've been fighting forever for that. It's incredibly important. My issue, Melissa, if I can just say this, is I've lived through a lot of increases in ECS money. I've lived through increases in education money. I've lived through many lean years as well. But my goal and my hope, my fierce hope, is that that money actually affects the classroom level. There are no parameters around these dollars. In other words, they go into education. But here's what often happens, and, I've lived through it as a superintendent and all the way to being a teacher, you know, and living through and saying, oh, wow, this is going to change. And it doesn't always change. And let me tell you why. Because this ECS money comes in, the education cost sharing money comes into the municipality. It, you know, it raises the minimum the minimum requirement for funding. So the municipality, in most cases, will only meet the minimum budget requirement. And so you might get you might get 1% more or 2% more. But look what inflation is and the cost in negotiated salaries and contracts. And so what happens is that additional dollars, those additional funding dollars, go into the operating budget to take care of those increases. And that means that it doesn't always reach the classroom level where we might hope for smaller class size in a Bridgeport. We might hope for more interventionists, more reading teachers, and it doesn't happen. And I've been there. I've seen it myself. So, you know, I am always arguing and fighting for money being given, certainly to the most challenged districts, but I would love to see more parameters around that money.
It kind of reminds me, Fran, of when you're donating to a nonprofit and people ask the question, how much of my money is actually going to pay the staff versus how much of it is going to fix the cause? And that's what that sort of reminds me of, you know. So if I'm understanding this correctly, you know, we don't know if these dollars are actually going to make it to the classroom. So, for example, teachers are still going to anticipate paying for their supplies to make sure that their kids have what they need in districts like Norwalk and Bridgeport and Stamford. Classroom sizes are probably still going to be outrageously big for one teacher to handle. Conditions being poor are still probably going to be in place, even though we're putting millions and millions of dollars into the education sector. Do I have that correct?
You have that correct, Melissa. I mean, I'm hopeful that some of those dollars will be able to reach the classroom level. But I remind you that we did have large influxes of dollars from ESSER funding over the last few years. And I would be, I'm pretty much in touch with teachers through CEA, Kate Diaz, who's president of the teachers union, and I have a wonderful relationship. We talk all the time, and I'm not sure that those dollars reached the classroom level in the way we would have liked to have seen. In some cases, yes. In other cases, no. And, you know, I would really like to see how that happened or why it happened. And let me just share one thing with you. When I was in Bridgeport, I was an administrator. There was a federal grant that came in. It was specifically for reducing class size. And we didn't have room at that time to reduce the class size to make more classrooms. But what we were able to do is to bring in new teachers and have them co-teach with a seasoned master teacher. So they got a year, and those kids had a year of two teachers in the classroom. We trained them in how to co-teach, how to break the classroom into having 14 kids each rather than a 28-number classroom. That was targeted money, and it worked incredibly well. We did it in first grade because we felt reading was happening there for the first time, et cetera. That's what I mean by targeted money.
Our governor signed a two-year, $51 billion state budget, which included a historic cut to personal income taxes, but it also included hundreds of millions of dollars going into education. We have Fran Rabinowitz here, who is the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, reacting to that amount of money being allotted for schools. Fran, would you say that this was a clear-cut bill, I guess budget, or do you think there was a lot of sort of modge podge, if you will, of legislation sort of tossed together to say, hey, we're totally investing in education, okay? Like, on the surface, yep, we're doing our jobs in Connecticut. We are doing that correctly.
Well, honestly, Melissa, I think the legislators did the best that they could at this point in time. But would I say that, you know, some of the bills are just outrageously huge, and we're still trying to take them apart because there's one thing in one bill and one thing that pulls that out of that bill in another bill. So it's incredibly complex. But let me be clear with a couple of things on the funding. I mean, I like parameters around funding, and we're going to, you know, the Speaker of the House, Matt Ritter, spoke to that and said, I hope districts use this money to increase salaries and improve working conditions. But that's a hope. It's not a you
demand,
must.
Right.
I'd like to get to that point. But there were some really good things. I mean, there is $10 million by the second year of the biennium for aspiring leaders, aspiring educators. That goes from high school all the way up to get some of our wonderfully gifted paras into the classroom and be able to pay for them to become certified. There is money in there for para health insurance. It's not a lot, but it's $10 million in the course of the biennium, which is wonderful. That's what they said they wanted. Health insurance was really important to them. And so that's what I mean about targeted money, Melissa. That will make a difference. And there is wonderful money in there for the Office of Early Childhood for increases in care for kids and that type of thing to help pay so that parents can send their kids to daycare and preschool.
So again, it's kind of an up in the year conversation because it, again, looks on the surface like this could be very helpful with a lot of the issues we're seeing, teacher shortages, bad conditions in certain school districts, making sure that people are actually incentivized to want to stay in this career path when it's become incredibly complicated in the year 2023. However, it's sort of we're not out of the woods yet in really understanding if, in fact, school districts are going to use that money to address those things.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that, Melissa. That's exactly captures it. We are not. They did a good faith effort in giving more dollars. Our teachers need and many may disagree with me, but the starting salary on average is about $48,000 in Connecticut. We need to be much higher than that, and that needs to happen if we're going to attract more, to have a living wage to pay for their families. So yeah, that's one. And number two, working conditions. And, you know, Kate Diaz and I and, you know, the teachers and the superintendents work together all of the time to really advocate for those two things, because those two things are incredibly important to the profession. I've also asked, and I'm hoping, that we have a year-long campaign about respect for the profession, because I also think that that is not what it should be.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. So those are the things that I'm hoping that we can really, really work on this year and get what we need for our excellent professionals that are already in the field and for those who will be enticed into what I think is the greatest career ever.
Well, we certainly will see. Time will tell. But also just as we comb through more of these documents, more than an 800-page document, we'll see really what it means for educators across our state. Fran Rabinowitz, I appreciate that you always come on the show and you give such great insight into these major topics. And I look forward to having you back on really soon. Thank you so much.
Melissa, I just want to say I can only offer the insight based upon the questions that you ask, and you are always prepared with wonderful questions, and I'm happy to comment at any time. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you, Fran. Always appreciate you. And by the way, Fran, mark your calendar. I'd love to have you back on maybe probably closer to the start of the next school year, but something that came to my attention just because my kid is entering real school, I call it, in the fall. But I noticed that the school days are longer than they were when I was in elementary school. Again, we're talking 30 years ago, but I'm wondering why that is. And I'm also noticing that recess doesn't seem to be that long. Kids don't get like enough of their arts or gym classes or music time or recess. It just seems like it's way more academic heavy than it was when I was a kid. But maybe I'm crazy. I don't know if it's always been that way, but I was going to pick your brain on that one too at some point.
I'll be very happy to talk on that. I'm very opinionated on that. I lived through no childhood when they cut it all out, and it's a mistake.
Okay, great. Well, maybe we can get you back on really soon then to talk about it. I've been really looking at that and dissecting that as my kid is entering school in the fall. And I'm like, what gives? What's happening? So, yeah, we'll talk about that the next time you come on. That'd be great.
Okay, Melissa. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Thank you, Fran. You too. And enjoy your summer. Fran Rabinowitz here on WICC. We oftentimes have Cindy Iadice on the show as well as Fran Mako of AAA. Cindy is the founder and executive director of the Flagman campaign, and her goal is to really push the importance of slow down, move over laws, not just here in Connecticut, but across the country. She's also hoping that more and more children become more active passengers in the car to make sure that their parents or their guardians are not distracted and that they do slow down and move over, especially when they see emergency vehicles on the side of the road. But who are considered emergency vehicles? Your cops, your firefighters, your emergency response teams. But we don't really think about people who are doing construction, for example, or tow truck drivers. Well, Cindy Iadice started this entire campaign because her brother Corey Iadice was killed a couple of years ago here in Connecticut on the Merritt Parkway, just trying to help a disabled vehicle when a driver slammed into him and killed him instantly. And now we're hearing from a Sacred Heart University graduate who is echoing the need to remind drivers about the slow down, move over law, and really recognizing the importance of tow truck driver safety. So joining me now is Selena Khan. And Selena is, again, a Sacred Heart University grad with this incredible vision to better protect our tow truck drivers. Selena, welcome. Thank you for coming on the show so early. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Selena, what made you want to focus on this? And also, congratulations on recently graduating this year. What made you want to focus on this?
Thank you for the graduation. And yeah, so I grew up in the towing industry. My dad owns Nelcon Towing and Recovery, and we have multiple locations throughout the state. So I was born into it on that end of things. And then he also owns the last privately owned ambulance company. So I got to see both sides of first responderness. And I saw the impact that slow down move over had on our EMS side, but I didn't really see it reflecting on the towing industry. And because I have a twin sister who's had a close call, as well as my dad who's had his own personal close call, it really struck home for me. And I really wanted to make a difference with that.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry. I'm glad to know that they're both okay. That was going to be one of my questions, if this is something that your dad has personally seen on the job. But it sounds like the answer is yes, and even your own twin sister, which is terrifying. Tell us about this company that you created, Life on the Line. What is that?
So, yeah, I started Life on the Line, and what I want it to be, it's still a brand new company. And so I'm in the process of working on that. As you know, with my graduation, I couldn't put my full focus on it at the time. So now that's been my main priority. And I wanted to bring awareness to the slow down, move over law in relation to the towing industry, because we have the largest statistic of every 6 days in the United States, a tow operator is killed. And that's, in my opinion, the largest statistic. And we get the least amount of respect, but we get killed the most. And so I feel like it's something that needs to be recognized and taken seriously.
Selena Khan is here, and she is a recent Sacred Heart University grad who created a company. It's called Life on the Line. It's dedicated to educating drivers about the move over law here in Connecticut and fighting for regulatory changes to make tow trucks more visible. How do we make them more visible, Selena, in your opinion?
So right now we are allowed to have yellow amber lights flashing when we are on the side of the road, or if we are transporting a vehicle and their wheels are on the road. But unfortunately, people are numb to those yellow lights. So what I've been doing is trying to get a law passed that's currently allowed in multiple states. I don't remember those states off the top of my head, but where red and blues are allowed to be flashing on the back of the truck just when stationary and just when we're on that shoulder to get people's attention. So that's one of the things I'm trying to get done, but it is a long process. It'll probably, if it gets passed, won't happen in for at least a year.
Have you ever been in touch with Cindy Iadice?
Yeah, so I actually know Cindy personally. She has started an amazing initiative, and she's doing amazing things, trying to get an education program started. And she's been working with Canada, I know, possibly the UK, and she brought the program to Fairfield this past within the last couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's doing great things.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the more voices we have from the tow truck industry, the better chance we have of seeing more action in states across the country and even, like you were saying, globally seeing an impact. What is your hope, Selena? What is your goal now that you have finished college? I would imagine you're entering the workforce, so I know life is busy. But what is your hope for this company? What do you want to see happen, at least to start here in Connecticut?
I want Life on the Line to be not just a company that sells merchandise and decals. I want it to be a company that brings, as always, the towing community together, which I really don't think is a lot to ask. Eventually, I would love to see Life on the Line decals on multiple towing trucks throughout the United States and possibly even Canada, just because the towing community is such a close-knit community. They've always been supportive, and I feel like this is something that can definitely be done. Because if we're the ones having each other's backs, we're the ones that are going to be able to get the recognition and respect of being a first responder, which is ultimately what needs to happen at the end of the day.
So, Selena, those decals you're talking about, is that something that I don't have a tow truck and I don't have anybody who works in the tow truck industry, but I'd love to get them for myself, for my husband, for my family, all of their cars. Like, I'd love to put that on our cars. Is that a possibility? And if so, where can we get them?
Of course, yes. So I'm selling it to the public as well as I will be selling some merchandise as well. And a small percentage of the proceeds that I make from selling this merchandise is going to be directly donated back to the survivor fund out of the Towing Museum for when you get killed in the line of duty. You get a money from the museum and they support your family. So my website's currently under construction. As I said, I just graduated, but for updates on when I'll be selling, when I launch that website, I've been posting a lot on my social media on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and my username is @LifeOnTheLineCo.
@LifeOnTheLineCo. What I will do, Selena, just because not all my listeners are on social media actively, but they would love to support your cause and use your website when it is up and running, I will follow your accounts and I'll keep people posted. But any idea, ballpark idea, when your website will be live so I can let people know that they could start shopping?
Yeah, within the next 2 months, it should be live.
Okay, so I'll kind of keep an eye on it and would also love if you wanted to come back on the show maybe near the end of the summer when the website is live to reintroduce yourself and reintroduce the product line and the purpose of it. Maybe we have you come back on the show to reintroduce that to our listeners.
Yes, that would be amazing. I would love to do that.
Fantastic. Well, Selena, thank you for the amazing work that you're doing. God bless your family. Please, I will pray that your father stays safe and all tow truck drivers out there. And I look forward to buying some of these products. Like I said, I very, very much agree and align with what you're talking about. And there is absolutely no excuse for why people who are working our highways should not be able to make it home safely at the end of their workday. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. I appreciate the support.
Absolutely. Again, Selena Khan is a recent graduate from Sacred Heart University, and she created a company called Life on the Line. The online store is not up and running just yet, but it will be in a matter of a couple of months. We'll keep you posted on that so you could support the cause. And in the meantime, if you want to follow her on social media, her username is @LifeOnTheLineCo. And I could post that when I put this on the podcast later on this morning. Selena, thank you so much.
Connecting commerce to your community. Bridgeport Regional Business Council President and CEO Dan Onofrio. Now on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Dan Onofrio of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council is back, and we are talking Restaurant Week in Bridgeport. Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm great. How are you this morning, Melissa?
I'm hungry. I know I have a little bit of time before Restaurant Week kicks off. It's coming back June 24th to July 1st. With more than 25 businesses already working on this and giving some kind of special or discount, this is the first time that we're seeing Bridgeport's Restaurant Week since 2012. Why? Why so long, Dan? What happened?
Well, I think there's a number of things. One is, there probably hadn't been a leading partner in trying to organize something like this in a while. I can't speak really to the history because I'm relatively new in terms of my four-year tenure here at Bridgeport, but it's been something we've been talking about. In fact, the Bridgeport Chamber and Downtown Special Services District and other groups have been talking about Restaurant Week just prior to the pandemic. And then, of course, the pandemic came. We said, okay, let's pause on this conversation. So the city has been great in terms of trying to, inject some enthusiasm into this. And we're just super excited that the city's putting it on. I know there's a lot of debate on, when the appropriate time to do a restaurant week is. A lot of restaurants prefer the winter into spring season since summer, people are out and about and, kids are out of school and things of that nature. But I think because we haven't done it for so long, I think it's fantastic that we're doing it now. Let's start pulling this thing together again and see what we can learn from it and what we could do better or change and adapt to for next year to make it bigger and better. So we're really excited about it. I know the restaurants we've been talking to and some of our partners have been really psyched about just the fact that we're doing something just to drive traffic, particularly in our downtown restaurants. People aren't thinking about coming to Bridgeport when they're thinking about going out to eat, but we've got so many great authentic restaurants. Coupled with the fact that we've got all these great shows that are coming through the Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater, so I think the timing is actually pretty good for Bridgeport in terms of hosting it now in June into July as the people are getting into concert season.
Well, and you don't have to worry about any of the winter weather. We don't really have to worry that much about the rain because we tend to have kind of dry summers for the most part. So it seems like it's a pretty prime time. Tell us about the cuisine in Bridgeport. For people who may not be familiar, Bridgeport has a pretty eclectic taste. They really have a lot of different cuisines that they offer.
Oh, yeah. Incredible. So, you name it. In fact, you can see the participating restaurants on the City of Bridgeport's website, which I'll give in a moment. But, it ranges from, you have Eat Noodle right on Fairfield Avenue that, it's got the faux, the noodle bowls to Joseph's Steakhouse to, Thelma's Soul Food. We've got some Chinese restaurants. There's so many Vazis, traditional Italian-American food. Coupled with, bakeries. Alicia's right around the corner at Lafayette, right here in downtown, is great. And even over in Black Rock, the parade was just there. There's some great places along Black Rock. So we're hopeful to get, really get a variety of not just authentic restaurants and places to visit, but also geography. The city is obviously pretty big. There's some great places scattered throughout the city that are just fantastic. So we're hopeful to get even more of a groundswell and hopefully break the 30 mark as we come up to Restaurant Week in a week or so.
So we have Dan Onofrio here of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council, and it's been over a decade since Bridgeport has had a restaurant week, and it is coming back, and it's going to be here June 24th until July 1st. And where can people go if they want to see the list of restaurants being offered, Dan?
Yeah, so we'll have a link on it with at the BRBC website. So brbc.org, you'll probably see a link there over the next couple of days as we finalize the restaurants. But right now you can see who's participating right on the City of Bridgeport website. If you go to bridgeportct.gov and then / restaurant week, you'll see all the participating restaurants. In fact, some of them already put up their menus and what they're offering for discounts. And that's something else to note. Some restaurant weeks, Melissa, they do a theme. Since it's 2023, some of them will say, okay, you get a fixed menu for $20.23. We're not doing that. Each restaurant, we're kind of giving them the liberty to kind of do their own special. So you'll have some that are buy one, get ones for drinks or, discounts on the menu, or some of them are actually doing a fixed menu. So there's a variety of choices and options, not just in terms of what to eat, but also what they're offering as discounts.
That's so true, because a lot of times Restaurant Week will give you a fixed menu if you want to participate in it. And people will say, well, there's not really a lot on this menu. And then they kind of miss the entire experience of that restaurant. But for example, if you went to Island Hut Jamaican Cuisine, they're offering 40% off all of their lunch specials. So like, that's kind of neat. They're not going to give you a fixed menu, but they're giving you 40% off a good section of the menu there. So a lot of great options, again, if you want to go to the Bridgeport City website and check out the restaurants that are already participating. participating. Speaking of good eats, Dan, very exciting stuff coming to the Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater, the first ever Pizza and Brew Fest, which is coming up in July. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's fantastic. You know, Connecticut embracing this, you know, we don't share a lot of the great things that we do in Connecticut. I mean, in Connecticut, as you know, we talk about it often on the show. It's a great place. You know, we have everything here. It may not be the best of the best of the best, but in the world of pizza, you know, arguably we have probably the best pizza in the country. And it's great to see people embracing and celebrating Connecticut as a, you know, kind of a pizza hub, you know. So the fact that the Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater is kind of, you know, bringing this pizza and beer fest to Bridgeport, it's always fun. You know, I mean, who doesn't like pizza and beer, you know? So it's really an exciting time. I just like the fact that people are rallying around some of the things that we do really great. In fact, earlier this week, we had the Connecticut Office of Tourism had a listening session for a lot of our smaller partners, you know, a lot of the museums and the folks that are still struggling getting back out after COVID. And we were talking about that very thing. Like, we have so many things here, and for whatever reason, you know, Connecticut natives, just, we don't talk about all the great things that we do here. We always talk about the negative, you know, and we need to start changing that perception. I think that's true in Greater Bridgeport too. You know, and I think we're starting to see a little bit of a shift, you know, with the enthusiasm around all the great assets and resources we have in the region. And look, if we don't celebrate it, who's going to do it? You know,
I agree.
You know, we need to embrace all the great things that we do here. And of course, pizza is one of them. Yeah, I grew up in Derby with Roselands, and Roselands is always one of the best pizza places. I think they're usually in the top 5, 10, maybe in the state. So it's great to see the Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater bringing our pizza culture to Bridgeport.
Yeah, I can't believe we've never done this before. I'm like, what do you mean this is Connecticut's first ever Pizza and Brew Fest? I'm like, what? We've literally had New Haven Pizza. We've had Frank Pepe's Pizza. We've had we've had Colony Pizza. Like, how in the world are we just jumping? I don't know. So I'm excited for it. I mean, I'm thrilled. I can't wait to go. And if people want to check it out, what's also neat about this is they're going to be doing a lot of different pizza panel discussions and demonstrations. There's like a dough throwing contest. There's craft brews, live music, all sorts of stuff that you can get in on. So if you want to learn more, you can go to ctpizzaandbrewfest.com. It's as simple as that. And Dan Onofrio, like I said, I'm very hungry for this summer, but it sounds like there are plenty of things to do in Bridgeport to make sure our appetite is well satisfied. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa. Talk to you soon.
All right. Dan Onofrio of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council here on WNCC.
It's time to get up and get moving. Workout Wednesday. Melissa in the morning on WICC 600.
Well, the weather is finally cooperating with us. We've been able to enjoy some gorgeous weather starting back in May, and we hope to do so continuing through the summer months. Did you know that regular walks, actually, that's great for strengthening connections in and between your brain networks? It's according to some new research today that we found in one of the Science Daily Journal articles. And joining us to talk more about this is Amy Linus of Workout Wednesday. She is our health guru, and she helps us with exercising and nutrition and everything else we need to live the longest and healthiest and happiest lives that we can. Hey, Amy, how are you?
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well, and I hope you are also.
I absolutely am. Thank you so much. I think this is a very exciting article because not only does it help with brain connectivity, but it says walking actually can improve memory in older adults. Were you shocked by this?
You know, I wasn't. I was actually excited to see some research backing it up this time. So I was really excited about this article.
Can you tell me why this would be the case, Amy? Why would walking do something so substantial for your brain?
Well, basically, so you have, you know, your cognitive function. There are three brain networks that actually control that cognitive function. And all three of those are engaged during that walking because you have to assess your surroundings. You have to put one foot in front of the other. So that's the exercise part of it. And you also have to navigate where you're going. So essentially, you're pulling together three different cognitive pathways in your brain. And that repeating over and over actually helps to keep the gray matter in your brain nice and healthy and the neurotransmitters working the way they're supposed to as well.
So how often should you be walking and how far should you be walking? Does it need to be outside or do you get the same effect on a treadmill? What do people need to know to get the best effects possible for their brain when it comes to walking?
So it is going to be best to do it outside, Melissa, and that is because you are going to get more oxygenated blood flow to your brain. So oxygen is going to be a little richer outside in that nice fresh air, but inside as well. If you are not able to go outside, if you're a little leery of, you know, traffic or crossing the street or things like that, absolutely inside is just as great. But yes, I mean, I would love to see you guys do that at least 4 to 5 times a week. I'm not pushing it, but at least 4 to 5 times a week for about 20 minutes or so, just to kind of get that blood flow pumping and moving and just opening up those airways and making sure those neurotransmitters are working the way they're supposed to.
Okay, Amy, I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus, but I know myself. And there are some times where I am getting that power walk on, like I am down by the beach and I am walking the whole pathway. It's just me, my music, I'm vibing, and I know I'm getting that power walk on. I'm getting a great walk in. But then there are those times where I'll say, for example, to a family member, to a friend, hey, let's go out for a walk and talk. And you know it's the casual walk, and you know your heart's not really pumping much faster than if you were just in the house watching TV, if you know what I'm talking about. So could you kind of redefine, you know, even if I'm getting outside, I'm quote unquote walking, and I'm doing it for 20 minutes, I would imagine you need a little bit of pep in your step to actually see some effects, correct?
Oh, yes. You definitely need a little pep in that step to see those effects. Absolutely, you do. So a way to kind of gauge that, you could even get yourself a heart rate monitor. The Apple Watches, the Apple iWatches actually can help you out with that if you have one of those. Or make sure that if you don't have either one of those and you just want to go ahead and get started, go outside, get that brisk pace going, and try to start talking. And if it's a little tough for you to start talking while you're doing that, then you know you got a good pace going.
I have also heard that if you're able to talk while you're working out, especially doing cardio, that that's actually a better workout. Is that true?
It is true. It is true.
Why?
Okay, so you are actually utilizing more oxygen when you're talking, and your heart rate is going to elevate a little bit more. So you're working a little harder when you're talking through that exercise. It's really tough for me to do, so God bless anybody who can, because I have a tough time with that.
I'm not good at it, and honestly, I don't really like talking after 10:01 every morning for the most part, because I feel like I've talked myself out. So I'm awful at it, and I feel like I'm more at a deficit by the afternoon if I'm going out for a walk or something with a friend, and they're like, if you want to just talk when we sit down, and I'm like, could we please? Because I'm not it's just, I'm not good. It's really not good. But I've been told that if you can talk while you're working out, that it is exponentially better for your health. And I'm like, well, girlfriend ain't there yet, but I'm working on it. I am.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
It is. You're right. It is. You're burning more calories when you're walking and talking. Definitely so, Melissa.
Well, one day. That's a goal one day. And maybe you and I will get there someday, Amy. But in the meantime, these are really great things to be thinking about. Something as simple as just getting out and getting a nice brisk walk going 20 minutes a day really can make a huge difference in the long run, especially with your memory and your connectivity for your brain. Really great information, Amy. If people want to connect with you, ask more questions, where do they go?
Sure. Come find me online, AmyLlinas.com, AmyLinas.com. I'm also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube under Amy Linus. I would love to connect with you guys offline as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Amy, I always appreciate getting your tips every single week for Workout Wednesday. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again next week.
Thank you, Melissa. Enjoy your day.
Thank you. You too. Amy Linus of Workout Wednesday here on WICC.